Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Frank Andreu, and I represent Anita Garg, who was the plaintiff in the underlying action and the appellant here before you today. This case comes before you for the granting of a summary judgment motion in which all of Ms. Garg's claims of disability under the Rehabilitation Act was granted, and her claims were summarily dismissed as a result. The reason that I brought forth the appeal today is because I do believe that there are issues of material fact that the trial court did not address sufficiently, or if at all, as to a couple of different points under the Act. Ms. Garg, as I have indicated in my brief, was a postal employee who developed a certain condition that limited her substantially, as we asserted, in the major life activity of working. The disability that the lower court used was the 2A definition, which meant that she was substantially limited, and Judge Norgal stated that she did not meet her burden of showing that. It is our assertion that the trial court did not address our other two claims at summary judgment regarding whether there was a sufficient record of such impairment with the Postal Service or whether she was regarded as having such an impairment so as to preclude summary judgment. The point in bringing the appeal is not whether we disagree with Judge Norgal's interpretation of the law. He only addressed one portion of our argument at summary judgment, and he did so by making factual determinations that I don't believe are sufficient or appropriate for a trial court judge to make. For example, whether the medical records were sufficient is a factual question. The limitation of her ability to work was a factual question. The duration of the illness, which we asserted in our briefs and at the summary judgment level, still exists today. With that in mind, we had asked the court to deny summary judgment and allow the case to proceed to trial, to allow a trier fact to determine whether or not these factual issues would fit into the definition of disability, even as high of a standard as that may be employed under the law.
Well, there's no dispute, is there, that she didn't follow up and get this allergy testing done that the post office asked her to do.
She did get the testing done.
Which would certainly inform us as to...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
She did get the testing done in May of 2002.
Right, after everything was pretty much over.
Well, she wasn't separated out from the Postal Service formally until September of 2006, with a effective date of March of 2006. She was put on a disability status or leave without pay status, which would have allowed them, that the postal facilities, to revisit the issue, in particular Dr. Ostrowski. And Ms. Garg's last day was in May of 2001. The test occurred, the results were sent, but there was no revisitation of the issue. So there's a factual question that's left open that we think would have precluded summary judgment. It's the issue of becoming a jurist, as a summary judgment motion would require, versus being a juror and making determinations of fact. If you're forced to make determinations of fact, then summary judgment isn't appropriate. In particular,
well, let me just make sure I have this the timing right, because I could be off. Wasn't it May 22nd that she was sent a letter saying that she was found unfit for duty, that they wanted additional testing, and that she was to submit something within 7 days, and then she was put on this leave without pay status, and she didn't furnish the requested medical documentation until December?
That's correct.
Of 2001?
Right, and I would even go further than to say that the actual allergy report from Dr. Moy didn't come into the Postal Service's possession until 2002.
Right, yeah, a year after she had been directed to get tested.
But throughout the time until the final separation in 2006, the Postal Service was given an opportunity to revisit the issue, and they never took it. So the burden goes both ways, and there was no correspondence that I was aware of or that was made part of the record to say, hey, wait a minute, you were too late. So the issue of waiver, if it does exist, goes both ways. The issue of whether or not Ms. Garg was disabled or should have been terminated was also being addressed during a grievance procedure through her union, And this was all pending up until much later in the case, even when we were in front of the district court. But the ultimate separation didn't occur until March.
Now, is she still holding those two jobs that she got when she left the post office?
No, she has a different job now. But the point that
and
I wanted...
And in the new job, is she required to interact with clients?
Yes. She was working as a pharmacy technician. So one of the issues that the Postal Service had brought was that there was no record of the impairment. We believe there's an issue of material fact regarding whether there was a sufficient record. For starters, the postal facility does have, in a facility this large, does have nursing staff who do keep medical records. Those medical records denote episodes, not only if her going to the emergency room, but of discoloration of her skin and rashes that were resulting on the workplace. Also, Dr. Ostrowski herself, in a separate inquiry in 1999, had written a letter to postal administrators saying that people were suffering from symptoms similar to Ms. Garg's, but in a different facility. However, in her deposition, Dr. Ostrowski did acknowledge that she saw similar sorting machines to those being used in Carroll Stream as were being used in the Palatine facility. The environment that created this dust, according to Dr. Ostrowski's own letter, was the way they were cleaned. Instead of vacuuming the dust, they were blown out. Regardless of whether, she stated in her letter, they don't violate OSHA standards, people are still getting sick. The fact issue remains as to whether or not the post office had a record and whether or not they were aware. And that's an issue of material fact that puts us into precludes summary judgment in this case. And it's something that Judge Norgel didn't address. He didn't address the 2B or 2C categorization of disability. I do see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will reserve. Thank you.
Tardif?
May it please the court, counsel. The bottom line here is, Your Honors, that Ms. Garg not only did not establish that she was disabled within the meaning of the Rehab Act, but also that she did not, the Postal Service did not fail to provide her reasonable accommodation to which she was entitled. This is a point that we deal with primarily as the first issue in our brief, and that is any argument as to disability becomes moot when you look at the fact that the plaintiff has not appealed the reasonable accommodation finding that the district court made. So from that perspective, the appeal is over at that point. The district court was correct to find that she was not disabled and correct to find that there was no reasonable accommodation that she was wrongfully denied. The only argument that counsel has articulated this morning with respect to the disability seems to be a narrowing of what they've presented thus far in the case. This morning they seem to be saying that there's an issue about whether or not she had a record of an impairment or was regarded as substantially limited in working. Neither of those are true, and there is no issue of fact as to either of those arguments as well. First of all, it is Ms. Garg who submitted to the district court the fact that the Postal Service employee who issued the notice of separation to her specifically did not regard her as disabled. There is absolutely no other evidence in the record that anybody at the Postal Service regarded her as disabled. I think what is abundantly clear from the record, and justifiably so, is that the Postal Service viewed Ms. Garg's condition rather skeptically. She was asked time and again to provide some type of medical documentation explaining to them what the nature of her condition was, where it came from, what needed to be done in order to provide a better working environment from her. They asked those questions precisely because of what Ms. Garg, standing alone, was reporting. Now, this court and many other courts have held time and again the inability to do one job for one employer, and even in particular that job in a particular building, does not qualify one as substantially limited in working as disabled under the Rehab Act. Her whole argument with respect to a limitation in working boils down to a claim that because the Postal Service found her unfit for duty, she somehow therefore either actually is substantially limited, is regarded as such, or has a record of being limited from the broad class of jobs of postal work. The record simply does not support the conclusion. The fitness for duty examination was requested by the supervisor at the time because Ms. Gard had been coming into work and complaining of these allergy-related symptoms and saying that it made her unable to do her job. She went to see Dr. Ostrowski, who's a contract physician for the agency. It's undisputed that Dr. Ostrowski does not have any managerial responsibility within the agency. Because of what Ms. Gard reported to Dr. Ostrowski said, please get the allergy testing done, bring the results back to us so we can determine what needs to be done. But in the meantime, because you are reporting that you're unable to do your job, that it's dangerous for you to be using the sorting machines, I'm going to have to find you unfit for duty. That was a fitness for duty finding limited to just her job of a mail processor. It was not a finding, as the plaintiff has argued, that she was limited from any and all postal employment whatsoever anywhere in the country. Now, to prevail, or rather to defeat summary judgment in the district court, Ms. Gard also needed to prove that there was some type of an accommodation that she had a right to. And this is assuming that she's disabled, which she certainly was not. But even if you assume that to be the case, she had to show an accommodation that she requested and didn't receive. The record doesn't support that she ever did that. In fact, she was accommodated by being switched tours for a period of 7 months and then given modified hours on the tour to which she was assigned. The ample proof, quote-unquote, that she refers to in her brief with respect to other jobs comes from literally the night or within a few days of her being deposed during the district court litigation. She went to, from what all I can gather, is USPS.com and did some type of generic job search that showed, yes, in fact, in 2006, July to be specific, the Postal Service was hiring people. But even with the benefit of a federal lawsuit over this matter, she failed to put any evidence in the record showing that in 2001, when she was asked to provide substantiation for her condition but failed to do it, that at that point in time, there were open jobs that she wanted. In fact, all she asked for in this litigation is a job in another federal agency, a claim that doesn't really bear much more discussion beyond mentioning it because it's so facially inadequate. The bottom line here is not only did she fail to prove that she was disabled under the Rehab Act in any major life activity, her claim that the Postal Service thought she was unable to do the job she had been hired for because of what she was self-reporting does not render her disabled. It does not show that she's substantially limited in working, and it absolutely does not create any genuine issue of fact as to whether she had a record of such an impairment or was regarded as such. And unless there are any further questions, we ask that you affirm.
Why don't you begin with counsel's point that since you're only appealing the district court's ruling that Gard didn't have a disability, and doesn't the conclusion that the district court made that the Postal Service made reasonable attempts to accommodate her, isn't that fatal to your lawsuit?
It is not, because this is a de novo standard of review on a review of summary judgment. My point in not addressing it was simply this. If this panel finds that Ms. Gard was not disabled under any of the definitions, then whether or not an accommodation should have been made is not an issue that needs to be addressed. She has to be found disabled first, and then an accommodation, whether or not one can be made, needs to be discussed. And that simply isn't the case here. Judge Norgel was wrong, not because he applied the law incorrectly, but because he precluded a fact discussion. He stepped into the shoes of a juror, and he made factual discussions as to whether the record was complete, the medical was complete, whether or not she can do the jobs. Half of Mr. Tardif's arguments back themselves up to fact questions, and that's the whole point of the appeal. Once you start playing the fact game, summary judgment is precluded. That's the whole point. You have the discretion in a de novo standard to look back at the record and see if I've made a sufficient claim under any A, B, or C of the ADA standards for disability, and then whether or not an accommodation should have been made. That goes back down to the trial court for trial on those issues. And if there are no further questions, I would just say one last thing regarding Ms. Garg's representations. They were unrebutted. There's no other testimony out there, and there's no credibility questions that can be made. You must look at the record to see if what she has stated establishes, or what's been presented, whether there was a sufficient record of her disability. And my time is almost coming due. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.